Hello, I'm Andrew Fizakis. This is number 0593, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and this is a special edition of the Stuff File program. Yes, I know last week was also a very special show too, our annual Meshach and Malik Christmas special. But this show is another perennial. It's our year-ending best of show that features just a small variety of some of the great guests we've had during 2020. There won't be any Stuff File news in this particular edition. It's just going to be snippets of past conversations. We'll also revisit a favorite idiot of the day at the end of the program as well. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0593, was science writer Andrew Fizakis, the night sky guy, and a frequent guest on this program. Regular listeners will know that Andrew is a member of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada and the author of National Geographic's Backyard Guide to the Night Sky. He's also a very, very good friend. You can check out his website at thenightskyguy.com. Thanks, Andrew, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get to the show, shall we? One of my favorite actresses through the decades has been Donna Mills. Most people know her as the evil Abby from Knot's Landing. But I remember her from her soap days in the late 60s when she was one of the stars of Love is a Many Splendored Thing on CBS. While trying not to scare her with my stalkerish kind of way about her career, we reminisced back on show number 0556. Full disclosure, I was a fan of yours from a very, very long time, going back before Knot's Landing. I was one of those rabid fans of Love is a Many Splendored Thing.
Oh, my God. That was a while ago.
And I wanted to bring that up for a couple of reasons, because I know you started working on a daytime soap on The Secret Storm. And then you did a movie called The Incident, and then you went to Love is a Many Splendored Thing. The other thing that I was a big fan of yours of was a television series that you did with Larry Hagman called The Good Life.
And, oh, my gosh, yes. Thank you for remembering it.
You know, it only lasted, what, 15 episodes? And I thought that for sure was going to be a hit. And the one thing I wanted to ask is, because you had done so many years on Love is a Many Splendored Thing, and I do believe that for actors, doing daytime soaps is some of the hardest work they'll ever do. What was it like? What was it like going to a sitcom where the dialogue and the pacing was different, the shooting schedule was different? What was that like after doing a soap opera every day?
Well, it was nice, actually, because it was, I don't want to say easier, because it's just different. You know, on a soap opera, you've got to learn, you know, maybe 40 pages a day, something like that. On a, you know, a film show, on nighttime television, you maybe do 7 or 8 pages a day. So in terms of that, it was easier. But doing comedy is not easy. So that was a little bit harder. And hopefully it didn't look like it was hard, but, you know, it is to some extent.
Going back to Love is a Many Splendored Thing, when you first got the role, because you were one of the first cast in that show, if I'm not mistaken, is that correct?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. So when you read the sides, you know, Sister Cecilia, who, the fallen nun, as it were, what was going through your mind when you said, okay, this is what I'm doing?
No, I loved it because on The Secret Storm, I played Rocket. A nightclub singer. And it was the total opposite of that role. So I love that. You know, any actor likes to play a range of roles, and that gave me a real opportunity. But it was funny at that time because on Splendid Thing, they used to call me Sister Mary Rocket. And that was the only name that character on Secret Storm had, Rocket. She didn't have any other name. That's what everybody called her. So it was really kind of funny.
Not too long ago, a couple of years ago, you went back to soaps. You did a stint for a while on General Hospital, correct?
I did, yeah.
And so that brought you back together with Leslie Charlson?
It did. We only ran into each other once or twice because, you know, you don't see everybody that's on the show because you're not on the same storyline, you know, so you can not be, even be there on the same day. So I only ran into her a couple of times, and it was wonderful to see her. We've had lunch a couple of times since. As far as I know, she's still on it.
Yes, she is.
All these years, it's quite amazing.
And for those who don't remember, going back to, again, Love is a Many Splendor Thing, you played sisters back then.
We did, yeah. I was a novice nun, and she was my sister, yeah.
So flash forward to what you're best known for, and that, of course, is Knott's Landing. When you got the role of Abby, and you were in basically a nighttime soap, again, going back to my first question, was that like doing a daytime soap with less dialogue, bigger budgets, and a greater wardrobe?
Well, sort of. But by that time, I'd done a number of movies for television, a lot of guest starring in, you know, nighttime dramas and stuff like that. So I was used to the pace of a filmed show as opposed to the taped daytime shows. I really like that pace. It gives you a chance to rehearse. It gives you a chance to hone the performance. And I really do like that. Although back then, when I was doing Splendid Thing, we had some time because we would come in the day before, block it in the rehearsal room, put it on its feet a couple of times, you know, have some rehearsal before we went to shoot it the next day. The way soaps are done now and the way I did it on General Hospital, you do 3 shows a day. And so there is no time for rehearsal. You barely have time to run through it once with the cameras so the poor cameramen know where you're going to go. So it's a whole different kettle of fish right now.
As an actress working on a daytime soap, or as someone who has had a highly successful career playing the character of Abby on a very popular Knott's Landing, what was it like meeting the general population in your day-to-day life? Did you ever have people who would mistake you for Abby in some of the bad things she did, or would mistake you back in the day for Laura Donnelly and some of the things she did?
Well, it's funny. Maybe I didn't have as much of a interaction with the public back when I was doing Splendid Thing. But when I was playing Abby, yes, I found a lot of people thought I was Abby, you know, which I feel very flattered because it meant I was doing a good job. But the fact of the matter is I went through a period where I go, why is that person being so strange and standoffish with me? I thought it was kind of friendly and nice, and you know, they're very keeping me at arm's length. And I realized finally that they thought I was Abby. You know, they'd take the hand of their husband and lead him away, thinking I was going to, you know, try and steal their husband away. So I had to work really hard to kind of overcome that, like be over nice, so that they would realize that I wasn't Abby.
She needn't have worried about not being nice enough. Donna Mills was a joy to talk to. In what was a rare double segment chat from show number 0556. Another guest that was featured on a double segment was a returning favorite, journalist and author Ivor Davis. He's had a front row seat covering many large stories in pop culture, from touring with the Beatles to meeting Elvis, and also covering the Manson family trials. But in all the previous times we chatted, I never touched on Ivor being a witness to the murder of Robert F. Kennedy in 1968, until show number 0575.
I had been covering Bobby Kennedy in the summer of 1968, I think it was, or was it 69? I tell you, whatever year it was.
It was 68.
68. Okay, yeah. Then I was right. In the summer of 68, I traveled with Bobby Kennedy throughout California because everybody in London and anywhere around the world thought he was going to become the next president. And winning California was a vital way to the convention. And so after Bobby acknowledged that he'd won California, he beat out Eugene McCarthy. And so we had got to know him. We'd traveled with him. We'd seen the way people were adoring him. His hands were swollen and bruised from all the hands he shook. And so he made the speech and said, on to Chicago. And then we followed him to a press conference that was going to be in another room. And as we followed him through the kitchen, and it took him through the kitchen, I'm not sure why, maybe it was a shortcut, I suddenly heard balloons popping. I thought they were balloons, but they weren't, because there was screaming. And I was 15 yards behind. I came to the door of the kitchen. Stephen Smith, who was Bobby's brother-in-law and a campaign manager, tried to stop me coming through. I said, what's going on in there? And I kind of pushed my way in, and there was Bobby lying on the floor in the arms of Ethel. She was screaming, give him air. And then 5 yards away, there was a small figure under about six bodies who was struggling. And it was, you've got to imagine, it was bedlam. It was women screaming, not again. And Bobby lying there looking pretty awful, and Ethel desperately looking for a doctor. And it's one of those signs. And by the way, my photographer, who's a famous photographer now called Harry Benson, who was traveling with me on the Bobby trip, was on the kitchen table taking pictures. I guess he was doing his job, of course. He was doing his job. And that image is forever etched in my mind, one that you cannot get rid of. And then we went to the hospital. We hung around at the hospital. And then I think it was Mankiewicz, his press man, came up several hours later and announced that Bobby was dead.
That was journalist and author Ivor Davis. He's the author of Manson Exposed, A Reporter's 50-Year Journey into Madness and Murder, and also The Beatles and Me on Tour. He appeared in a double segment back on show number 0575. He's also the first person to show up on our Best Of show 2 years in a row. Another person who is always a joy to talk to, and we've spoken on several occasions. In fact, she's featured in my book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. It's actress Alison Arngrim, who is best known for playing evil Nellie Olson on Little House on the Prairie. I'll find any excuse to talk to her, and the early COVID lockdown of 2020 gave me a great opportunity. Alison decided that she was going to read all of the Little House books by sharing two chapters live every day on Facebook. So we caught up with her back in April on show number 0558.
When this hit, and I had just come back from a tour of France, I had managed to get in my last autograph show in February in Arkansas, and then everything in the world got canceled. I'm very lucky my husband, Bob, is listed as an essential employee. It's infrastructure, construction things, so for the airport, so he has to go. But I realized everything I do creatively and for a living went poof! And I went, well, this is interesting, but what exactly am I supposed to do now? And I thought, I got to do something that's calming and relaxing. I'll go back to the beginning. I'll read the Little House books. Swear I was going to just sit and read them in my living room. And then I went, well, if I feel better doing this, maybe other people would like it. I should share. So I went on Facebook Live. And every day at 1:30, I sat down and I put the phone in a tripod, and I get my bonnet and, milk and cookies, a snack of some kind. And I turn on Facebook Live and I read two chapters of Little House on the Prairie.
And when did you start this?
Actually have to think. I don't remember. It's been weeks, because it's become this ritual. It's been a couple of weeks. Well, I'm on the third book, for heaven's sake. I started doing this, I guess, pretty early on in this madness, somewhere, I guess, April, because I've read all of Little House in the Big Woods, and then I start to do Farmer Boy, which is about Almanzo, but I talked to Dean Butler, who played Almanzo in Little House on the Prairie, and I said, do you want to read a chapter of Farmer Boy, because it's all about your character? He wound up reading the whole book, Farmer Boy, and now I'm doing Little House on the Prairie, which is the third book, and we're blazing through that, and then it's going to be On the Banks of Plum Creek, and of course Charlotte Stewart, who played Miss Beadle, will then sort of guest with us and read a couple chapters. So this has been going on for three books. I actually have to look at my page and, like, look at videos and go, because we kept them up there. So somewhere is the video of when I started this madness.
You played Nellie Olson for years on Little House on the Prairie, mm-hmm. and now that you're reading these books out loud, I'm just wondering, do you have a nicer inflection when you get to the parts that involve Nellie? Is she nicer in your reading?
Well, that is the next book. We're just a few chapters away, and then when they go to On the Banks of Plum Creek, because in the book, Little House on the Prairie, the one I'm in now, is the book the pilot was based on. And it's so crazy, because just now I was listening to Melissa Gilbert and her husband, Timothy Busfield, who are up in a cabin in the Catskills hiding out, are doing a podcast. And she just did a whole podcast talking about Little House on the Prairie. And it was really weird, because I'm like, right, because the pilot is based on the second the third book, Little House on the Prairie. And the series is based on the fourth book, On the Banks of Plum Creek, when they go to Walnut Grove. Very complicated. Hardcore fans know this. Hardcore fans are going, yes, of course, we all know that. But Banks of Plum Creek is when Nellie shows up, and I'm really excited about that, because one of the first lines about Nellie is, Nellie Olson was very pretty. I like that part. So yeah, no, I'm going to go full, I'm going to wear the wig for that. I got the bonnet, but I have the wig, not the wig, but I have a wig, and I will wear the Nellie wig when I start reading Nellie scenes. I am that insane. Yes.
Had you read the books before, by the way, even though you played the part, had you read the books?
Yes, I did. I had not read them before the show. This is a big thing with all the actors of the show. We kind of go, had any of you read the books before we did this thing? Melissa had read like one or two of the books, because she was at that age in school. She'd read, I think, A Little House in the Big Woods, but almost no one in the cast, I mean, Michael Landon had read the books. I had never read the books when I went to the audition and got the show. It was very embarrassing. They're like, oh, we're making a show about these books. And I was like, who? Soon as I got the part, I was like, oh, my God. And I went out and got On the Banks of Plum Creek and read all about Nellie Olson and went, oh, wow, okay. Charlotte Stewart, who was Miss Beadle, says she got the part, same thing, she got the part, and she went out and bought a book, and I think it was By the Shores of Silver Lake. It's one of the really sad ones. And she said, I start reading the book, and in five pages, you know, Mary's gone blind, and the dog dies. And she was sort of horrified. She's like, this sounds very sad. So we all wound up running out and buying the book. So I read the books right after I got the job. And then over the years, I've gone back and reread them. And just recently, in the last year or so, they came out on Kindle. So they are out on Kindle. And so I was reading them on my Kindle and going, these are really good. And so I have the hardcovers, and I have them all on Kindle. And so that's when I said, I'm going to go back and really read them, just sit down and read them from beginning to end. Because I haven't read them in order. I never read them in order. And but now I decide, well, why not do it live?
That was Alison Arngrim from Little House on the Prairie fame, from show number 0558 back in April. And yes, she is still going strong, reading chapters from the original books every day while wearing a bonnet on Facebook Live. You can catch the live ones plus all the previous readings on Alison Arngrim's Facebook page. The various lockdowns and social distancing mandates have put a crimp in the lives of many people, not just actors, and some people have had to become creative in order to earn a living in these times. One such person is Britain's Paul Durham, the former cruise ship worker who opened up his own ferry service only to see COVID almost wipe that business away. He appeared on show number 0578 to talk about how he combined his past life with his current one to create Ghost Cruise Tours. They say that necessity is the mother of invention, so as I mentioned, you got this idea gazing out of the English Channel at these ghost ships, basically. How many are normally moored in the area that you live in at any given time?
We went out today and there was four ships out there. We've had up to six, and occasionally it goes down to one or two. But I know the captain's on a couple of the ships, so I can talk to them and get the inside information whether they're going to be there or not.
They're not completely ghost ships. They have to be staffed to a certain amount of people. But how many people would be on any of these given ships at any time?
Yeah, I'm guessing about 80 to 100. You've got some people on the bridge. You've got people in the engine room. You'll have an electrician or two. And then you'll have the hotel staff to look after all those people.
And again, to give us an idea of what the normal capacity is, 80 people on these ships right now, when it's normal times and they're a sea, how many people, how many crew?
The smallest ship we got out there is the Aurora. I've actually been on that one. I worked on that one for a while when she was new. She holds about 1,900 passengers and about 800, well, nearly 900 crew. There is one out there called the Allure of the Seas. She can take an incredible 6,000 passengers, and her crew complement is 2,200. So they are certainly ghost ships.
When you came up with this idea, I'm guessing you weren't quite sure how successful they might be. Were you concerned at all that some people would want to see the ghost ships? Are you surprised by the success?
As we came out of lockdown, the ferry wasn't doing very well, our conventional ferry from Muddiford Quay to Muddiford Beach. So I just made an announcement one day. Anybody want to go and see the ships? Because every time you go down to Muddiford Quay, you can see them in the distance. And I was shocked. Lots of people wanted to go and see these ships. So we put it on Facebook, and lo and behold, 4 hours later, we had filled up 4 trips.
And as I mentioned, you're socially distancing, obviously, so you have 30 passengers at a time. For you, what is a normal complement of passengers when we aren't socially distancing?
Yeah, on our ferries, a license for 80 passengers. And as you quite rightly said, now we can get about 30 passengers on.
So what is you worked on the ships, as I said, 27 years before settling down and taking over these two ferries. So you have a certain knowledge of these ships. You may have worked on some of the actual ships that are out there. What are the questions that people are asking you, or what are some of the insights you're able to give during your tours that people find fascinating?
Yeah, I've worked on the ship, so I can answer all the questions that the passengers on are asked. It's quite interesting. The passengers that come on our boat to go and see the cruise ships, quite a few of them have done cruises themselves. And the other thing is, the other passengers want to do a cruise. So everybody is very interested in the cruise itself.
These ships are huge. You mentioned the complement that it can have as far as staff and passengers. These are big vessels. Your ferry is not. How physically close do you get to these things? And they just must really dwarf your vessel.
Yeah, our ferry is 10 meters long. These vessels are, I'm changing into feet now, but these vessels are up to about 1,000 feet long. So what's that, about 360 meters long. Their beam going from left to right is usually about 32 meters should they wish to fit through the Panama Canal. And we are allowed to go within 50 meters of these vessels. Bearing in mind the vessels are probably 50 meters high, we're literally looking up at 45 degrees at these ships.
So it's like being in an urban center and looking up at skyscrapers.
Exactly. And the advantage is you never see a ship at anchor. It's usually in port, and there's always a building or something in front of it. We can literally circumnavigate this massive ship, which can be up to 1/5 of a mile long. We can circumnavigate it at only a distance of 50 meters. When we get back, I always ask the passengers, did you think we could get that close to a ship? And no is the answer.
That was Paul Durham from Ghost Cruise Tours. His knowledge of the ships that he circumnavigates and his history in the business makes him the consummate tour guide and storyteller for seafaring fans. You can hear more of him back on show number 0578. Time for us to cruise into a break. There's more Best of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, coming your way in just a bit.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated.
We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the common folk. It all comes to you here on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
This is a special edition of the Stuff File program, looking back at snippets of some of the conversations that we've had over the past year. And speaking of conversations, let me take a moment to tell you a little bit about a book that I'm very proud of. It's called Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. Written by me and published by Bear Manor Media, it's a compilation of just a few of the myriad of celebrity interviews I have done over the years. I've already mentioned Alison Arngrim. There are others such as Oscar-winning stars Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer, Emmy-winning stars like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner, Tony-winning stars like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar, a host of TV icons like Buddy Ebsen, Bob Denver, Dick Van Patten, Gary Coleman, and the ever-popular Much, Much More, plus two guys who left their footprints on the moon. So, check it out. You'll find it on Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. It's available in hardcover, softcover, and also for your e-reader, which means you can download it and start reading immediately. You'll find the links on our website at thestufffile.com. So, buy the book. It's a page-turner. And speaking of celebrities I've had the pleasure of chatting with, sadly, each year, some of the guests on our program leave us for the great beyond. This year, there were four such departures. When that happens, we replay parts of their previous appearances. Right at the tail end of 2019, we lost legendary Broadway composer Jerry Herman at the age of 88. He had died on Boxing Day. So on the first show of 2020, we featured some of an interview we had with Jerry going back to October of 2001.
I was bitten by the Broadway bug because I had parents who loved Broadway musicals, and whenever they were able to afford a night out, they would take me to see the latest Broadway show. We lived in New York City, and the first thing I ever saw was Annie Get Your Gun with Ethel Merman. I came home that night and I announced to my parents, I was just a kid, but I announced to my parents that that's what I wanted to do, that I wanted to write songs like that and I wanted to entertain people. It's always been a goal. My father thought I was crazy. My mother thought it was wonderful. I think I almost caused a divorce in the family. But as good luck would have it, I found myself on Broadway in, just a few years after my college graduation. And I was very young and very inexperienced, but I was nominated for a Tony Award for Milk and Honey, and there was no stopping me after that.
Your first big success, as you mentioned, was Milk and Honey, but you alluded to an even bigger success, I guess, the one you had in 1964, and that was Hello, Dolly.
Correct. That was just a phenomenon, and still is. There is never a night somewhere in the world there's not a production of Hello, Dolly. It ran on Broadway for 7 full years, and for a long time was the longest-running musical of all time. It was eclipsed by Cats and, I believe, A Chorus Line. But in our 7th year, we were the longest-running musical of all time. So it really was a very exciting thing for a young songwriter to stand in the back of the theater and hear the people screaming and laughing and applauding. It's given me a very good life. You know the list of ladies that have done Hello, Dolly? Do you have time?
Sure, go ahead. Tell us a few, please.
Well, it opened with Carol Channing. Then we had Ginger Rogers, Betty Grable, Pearl Bailey, Martha Raye, Phyllis Diller, and we closed with Ethel Merman. But while this was going on, Eve Arden was doing it in Chicago, Mary Martin was doing it in Vietnam, and the list just goes on. And then, of course, Barbara Streisand did the film version. So it gave me the chance to work with about 20 wonderful ladies and get to know them personally and become you know, have them become friends of mine.
That was Broadway musical legend Jerry Herman. Ironically, it was last year on this show that we said goodbye to one of his biggest leading ladies, Carol Channing. Back on March 17th, actor Lyle Waggoner passed away at the age of 84. Lyle went from a staple on The Carol Burnett Show to co-starring on Wonder Woman to finding his true success and wealth from the business he started in 1979 called Star Wagons, a company that leases customized location trailers for use by the entertainment industry. We chatted with Lyle back in April of 1999, part of which was heard on show number 0553.
We have a company called Star Wagons, and we build and supply the industry with all of the dressing trailers, makeup trailers, and wardrobe trailers that they use on location.
Now, you've turned this into, it's quite a business for yourself, but if I'm not mistaken, I understand this initially started as a tax shelter?
Yes, actually. When I was doing the show...
So you can say that. The IRS isn't listening to this show. We're in Canada, so you don't have to worry about that.
No. When I was doing the show Wonder Woman, you remember that? Did you get that in Canada?
Oh, yes.
I was doing the show with Linda Carter. If you saw the show, you'd probably know what she looks like.
Oh, yeah.
And I went to work the first few days, and our dressing rooms were right next to each other. I discovered there was a little hole in the wall there. You could see right through it.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose I should have patched it up right away, but I figured, what the heck, let her look if she wants to. So a few weeks later, they decided they were going to do a lot of location shots, and so they got us both motorhomes. And I was very impressed because it had to be $35,000 or $40,000 worth of equipment. And I said, the company buy this for me to use? They said, no, we rent it from some individual in the valley. And I said, well, if I had one, would you rent it for me? They said, well, of course. Your contract says you get a motorhome, then say where we have to get it. So I went out and ordered one. And when it came in, we sent this other fellow's back. And they rented that coach from me for the 3 years that I was on that show. And during that time, I discovered there was no company, no organization that had a fleet of this equipment available to the studios. Whenever they needed one or two or three, they had to go out to one or two or three people. So I told them that if they wanted new motorhomes to call me, I would go out and buy them for them and supply them with brand new ones. It wasn't that I was wealthy. It was just that in those days, we had what they called an investment tax credit here in the United States, where if you had a business and you bought equipment for that business, you would get a 10% investment tax credit right off of your income tax. So I figured if I bought enough of these motorhomes, I would pay no taxes. And that's pretty much what happened. But eventually, in 1986, our government, in all of its wisdom, decided that this was not a good deal and canceled the whole thing. But by that time, I was pretty well established, and we could continue on and grow the business as we have for 20 years now.
It seems ironic that you start a business with something that basically is a necessity in the Hollywood community, but no one else thought of doing that.
It is ironic. I never could figure it out to this day why somebody, certainly in the transportation department, wouldn't put together a fleet of motorhomes or trailers or vehicles of some kind and make them available for rent. But they didn't, and I saw that void and was lucky enough to go ahead and follow it through. Now we have a fleet of about 300 of these trailers, and we have a little plant in Sylmar, California, where we build them as fast as we can, which isn't that fast. It's about 30 or 40 a year because they're very complicated, very sophisticated. But we've got quite a niche here that we are filling.
As I mentioned right off the top, Carol Burnett's show has found a new life here in Canada on the Comedy Network, and that's big news because it's been a few years since we've seen the repeats when they first stripped it down as Carol and Friends a couple of years ago.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. That means there might be a residual or two coming through. I might be able to get my couch recovered this year.
You were on that show for all of the 11 years, right?
No, I was on it for 8 years, and then I knew the show couldn't last forever, like every television show gets canceled eventually, and they had never syndicated a variety show. And I said, boy, well, you know, once this goes off the air, I'll have nothing, so I better look for something that's got possibilities in syndication. So the Wonder Woman people came, offered me this position, and I said, okay, let me do that. Well, as it turned out, the Burnett Show was one of the most successful syndicated shows in the history of television, to show you what my foresight is like. Burnett Show was the most fun of all.
Mm-hmm.
The rehearsals were absolutely hysterical, and if they could have videoed those and shown them on HBO, that would have been a successful show, too, but he couldn't show it on a family channel.
Now, what was it like after 8 years on a successful show when you suddenly walked into into the offices and said, "Hey, folks, it's been wonderful, but I'm leaving."
It wasn't fun, but I thought at the time that it was a practical move to make. And Harvey did the same thing a couple of years later. They made a few changes during the final years of the Burnett Show. It worked out well for me because if I hadn't have left the show, I wouldn't have discovered this business. And this business is really, really what I wanted. So fate works in strange ways.
That was actor-turned-businessman Lyle Waggoner from show number 0553. You can go back to that show and listen to more of his memories about his days with Carol Burnett and the gang, plus on Wonder Woman and more. Now, every year we lose someone who really, really does die way too soon, and sadly, this year wasn't any different. Actress Naya Rivera, one of the stars of Glee, was only 33 years old when she perished in a drowning accident while she was out boating and swimming with her 4-year-old son. While her son Josie was found unharmed on July 8th, alone on a boat the two had rented, Rivera's body was finally discovered 5 days later. I first spoke to Naya back on Stuff File program number 0006 in October of 2009 and revisited part of our conversation on show number 0570. At the time, I asked her if she was surprised by the meteoric rise that Glee had right out of the gate.
Yeah, I sort of am, but then again, I'm not at the same time. Just because, you know, we were so excited about the project and every week getting the scripts and reading the storylines, we knew that we had something special, and we had a good feeling about it, and so we expected it to be kind of the hit that it is now. It's just really good to know that everyone else enjoys it just as much as we enjoy working on it.
Everyone likes to pigeonhole shows, and when somebody says, oh, there's a television series that's coming on, and it involves a lot of singing and dancing, people like to look back in history to see what succeeded and what hasn't. And in television, not a lot has. And the first thing that comes up is, uh-oh, it's cop rock again.
Yeah, I hear that all the time. And I, like, didn't even know what cop rock was. And I did my research, and I'm like, this is nothing like Glee. But, yeah, we get a lot of comparisons to things like that, and you know, the High School Musical question comes up all the time. But I think that people have really had a chance now to see that it is unlike anything that's ever been done before. And just because it does have some of those same elements, you know, singing and dancing in high school, doesn't necessarily make it a hit like High School Musical or a failure like Cop Rock. And I think that you really kind of have to make that judgment for yourself. And I think that they have.
The character you play on the show, as I mentioned, is Santana Lopez. She is one of the cheerleaders. And they're not the nicest girls in the group, the cheerleaders. And I'm just wondering if you've ever come across people like that in your real life.
Yeah, I definitely have. You know, I went to high school just like everyone else. And I had popularity issues with popular girls and whatnot. And I have. But I draw from that and put that into how I play my character, how I play Santana. And I guess you could say that that was a major blessing.
You've been at this a long time. I understand that your first television show as a regular was The Royal Family with Red Fox and Della Reese back when you were 5 years old. Did you always know this was something you wanted to do?
Yeah, pretty much. I've always been involved in the entertainment industry, and I've always, you know, been acting and singing. It was pretty organic and pretty natural, and I feel like, you know, I've just been always doing this, and I'm really good at it, so why not stick with it?
When it comes to child actors, there's either the fearless child actor or the precocious child actor. Were you just fearless when you started doing this? I mean, working on a sitcom with a live studio audience and veteran performers, or were you even aware of what you were involved in at that tender age?
Well, I was definitely aware, just because, you know, I would always be running lines with my mom or going getting headshots taken. So I was definitely aware of the process of it. And I think that I was pretty fearless, as most kids are at that age, no matter what they're involved in. And I think that's actually awesome. And I wish that I had some of that fearlessness now, being 22, just because it's weird how nerves creep up, you know, when you're older and you have a sense of how people perceive you, and I wish I didn't have that.
You've made the transition from child actor to adult actress. A lot of people don't have such an easy time, or let me rephrase that. Did you have an easy time?
In that transition, no, I don't think it's easy. I don't think this business is easy for anyone, really, but especially for someone who's been doing it since they were little, you know. There's always a weird phase when you realize that you're not a cute little kid anymore that's just going to go in and make people smile and feel good. You really have to focus on your craft and really learn how to audition and kind of act all over again. And it takes a lot of self-confidence to do so. So it's awkward, but I'm glad that I got over that hurdle.
That was actress Naya Rivera, who sadly drowned at the age of only 33 back in July. That conversation was originally from October of 2009. And a great character actress who was always full of life was Conchata Ferrell, who was best known for playing the housekeeper Berta on 2 and a Half Men. Conchata was 77 years old. She had suffered a heart attack in May and never recovered, eventually going into a long-term care facility, put on a respirator and dialysis, then a hospice facility, until she passed away on October the 12th. We spoke back in May of 2009. That was at the six-year mark of her role as Berta, halfway into the dozen years that she played the feisty character.
When I auditioned for the role, I was only supposed to do 2 shows, and they were looking for, I think, something a little more ethnic than me. But they were not quite sure what they wanted to do with her, so they brought in, you know, all the usual suspects, all the character people. So I, you know, they asked me for a European, Middle Eastern European accent, and I thought, well, you know, I do a fairly decent Russian accent, and I worked it, and then I worked it in my own voice, and I went, I'm going to ask him if I can do it twice, because I do it better in my own voice. And I got there, and there was about 22 women there, and I went, they're never going to listen to it twice. So when I went in, I said, I know you're looking for an ethnic kind of a approach to this role, and I said, but, you know, I come with my own ethnicity, and I think that this works better in Trailer Park. and they laughed and said, whatever makes you happy. And I think one of them actually fell off the couch when I read it. So what they did was they took that Trailer Park thing and ran with it. So that's the contribution that I have made. I brought Trailer Park to Malibu.
Now, many years ago, you were on a sitcom.
Hotel Baltimore.
Hotel Baltimore, yes.
Yes.
A Norman Lear sitcom. And one of the things that was interesting is that Norman Lear had a way of finding people on the stage and bringing the television. Was that the situation with you?
Well, Hotel Baltimore was a play.
Right, exactly.
And I was in the play. I did April in the play. And I did it, I think, 377 times. Some of Norman's people saw me. And when he came to New York, he came to see it, and so I just sort of went with it. He just brought me out. He would have brought Judd Hirsch, who played the desk clerk, but Judd was already committed to a show called The Law. So, yeah, you know, he found me there.
When you were assigned to do that show, and unfortunately it only lasted, what, 13 episodes?
13 episodes. We were Norman's first failure.
I was about to say, Norman had a great track record, but albeit most of that track record was with CBS.
Yes.
Did ABC. Did you think this was, you know, okay, this is it, this is my ticket?
Yeah. I think probably I did. It was more important to me when I found out that he had bought the play.
Right.
It was more important to me that nobody else knew April. She was given to me as a Christmas present by the playwright.
Really?
Yes. So I felt like she was mine. You know, I created her. I breathed life into her. And it was so important to me that I do it. I don't know if I thought about my ticket, because when I got out here, my dressing room was bigger than any place I'd ever lived.
Another great role that you were known for is you had, 15 episodes on L.A. Law?
I had a year.
A year?
I had a year on L.A. Law, so I guess that would be...
As Susan Bloom?
As Susan Bloom, yes. She was one of my very favorite roles.
Why is that?
Because she had power.
Mm.
And it's, I always like to play a woman who's got something that I'd like to have. It sort of lets you walk a mile in somebody, you know, in a pair of shoes you'd really like to wear.
Right.
And she was richer than God. And and she had power. And it was really fun. She was really fun.
Well, Berta has power. No one messes with that woman.
Well, Berta has enormous power. You know, Berta has absolute confidence in who she is. And she just doesn't worry whether anybody likes her or not. You know, she just is who she is. And she's, I think, you know, I find a great deal of pleasure and enjoyment at the ridiculousness of these rich people.
You know, when, again, going back to the ABC experience, you were on Hot L Baltimore. It didn't work out. It was a Norman Lear show, and everyone thought, well, this is going to take off. So have you had any difficulty handicapping projects you're working on? In other words, when you got 2.5 Men, and again, albeit you, it was only for 2 episodes, but when you saw it, when you got the script, did you say, oh, this is a hit?
No, I didn't. I mean, it was a wonderful script. They're wonderful writers. But I love the character, and I usually just go, I just approach from the character. And I did know that it was already picked up because, you know, I mean, I didn't do the pilot. I did the first show that they shot, other than the pilot. And it was only supposed to be, like I said, a 2-show arc. But the thing of it is when I did the first show, I came home and I said to my husband, I went, boy, I hope they like me as much as I like them, because I fit here. I don't know why I fit here, but I really fit here.
And that she did. That was actress Conchetta Farrell from show number 0583. And those are the Stuff File guests we lost this year. And Stuff File program fans, you can hear full versions of these and other celebrity conversations through the years by going to our Patreon page and becoming one of the select patrons of the show. Just go to patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. We have more of our special edition of the Stuff File program, a best of retrospective look at some of the conversations we've had over the past year. We'll be back in a bit.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments. Hi, this is Ben Patrick Johnson, voiceover actor, male model, and all-around nice guy, some days. When I'm not voicing blockbuster movie trailers, TV promos, or doing charity work like this, I also write novels. I have 4 of them out, and I know, it's a gift. Anyway, my latest novel is actually my most personal. It's called If the Rains Don't Cleanse, which tells the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo, loosely based on my own parents. Everyone thinks you should read it, including me, of course. You can order it right now. It's just a mouse click away at Amazon.com or Amazon.ca. You'll find links for it, along with several reviews, on the podcast page at www.peteranthonyholder.com. Remember the title, If the Rains Don't Cleanse, by me, Ben Patrick Johnson. Buy a copy because, I got to be frank, doing voiceover liners for Peter Anthony Holder's podcast, it isn't exactly paying the bills. If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Coming to you from the outskirts of sanity, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Welcome back to a special year-end edition of the Best of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Here on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. We're just about out of time, so let's call this segment the Speed Round. Speed Round music, please. People collect calendars. Perhaps you might want to buy one from Kevin Beresford of the UK that features roundabouts.
It started when I ran a small company, a printing company in Redditch. Redditch is a small town, but it's a new town, and it hasn't got a lot going for it. But what it did have was a copious amount of roundabouts. And just for fun, just for a laugh, we thought we'd produce a calendar, Roundabouts of Redditch. Little did we realise that calendar sold round the world. I did numerous TV interviews, radio radio interviews. That in turn spurned the Best of British Roundabouts, and it was then when I got really interested in roundabouts. Now we do roundabouts of the world now, so that's our most ambitious project to date.
So, as I mentioned in the introduction, you've traveled all around the country for the past 17 years. Have you traveled beyond British shores to check out roundabouts?
Oh, yes, indeed. Every time I'm on holiday, I'll always go out and take photos, especially in Spain and France. They've got some of the fantastic roundabouts. A lot of people think roundabouts is a British invention, but it's not. It was invented really in New York City, the first one in Columbus Circle. It was the French really that took up the idea, and they've got something like 35,000 roundabouts now, as opposed to 25,000 roundabouts that Britain has.
Or perhaps you might want to head to Sweden and pick up a calendar by Geert Vegan, who photographs posed squirrels.
If I want to have the squirrel looking like they are behind the piano and looking at me, then probably I would put some food in the air in a small bucket, but a little bit in front in the air of the piano, because I don't want to have it too long in the end of the piano. I want to have it in the beginning, so that the piano is in focus also. And sometimes I make noises to get that moment that he's looking at the camera and behind the piano, because the foot is exactly at the point where I want to have the squirrel standing. And probably I would put some food, some seeds, maybe some nuts on the piano themselves also.
Squirrels playing a piano too big for you, you say? How about Walt Noon in California, who has a flea circus? They play piano too.
I wanted for the longest time to teach a flea to play a piano, and to build a playable piano for a flea has been something I've been working on actually for a couple of years. They can hit a couple notes now, so I'm slowly getting there, but smaller and smaller is actually it's already the world's smallest act, and I think that's the thrust 10 years later.
Now, if I remember from when we chatted way back in 2009, and by the way, people can go into our archives at stufffile.com and check out show number 0003 to hear when we first chatted. I remember at the time you talked about the fact that fleas do not have a long life. So
no.
You have to constantly train fleas because they don't live that long.
That's true. Well, the funny thing is, you know, I make the same claim that a lot of the zoos and SeaWorld and all that make, because I've had a lot of people that are upset that think a flea in a circus is being abused. But a flea can actually live, when it's cared for as long as 6 months when you're a trained circus flea. Whereas in the wild, other than a dormant phase that fleas have where they can live many years in dormancy waiting for somebody to walk by and get a meal, in nature they don't seem to live more than about 30 days. So actually my hand-fed and trained fleas are well cared for, and up to 6 months is the record that I've had a flea survive so far.
And finally, if you're a reader who ends up with a batch of books, perhaps you might want to become a book fairy and give them away. First, you have to go to Cordelia Oxley's London website at ibelieveinbookfairies.com and buy some stickers.
So the person leaving the book just pops the sticker on the front. You can get the stickers from the Book Fairy website, and they might put a little bookmark, or they might write a note inside saying what they liked about the book. We've also got some new kind of library card style stickers where you can write your thoughts on the book and where you read it and where you found it. And then they can just choose somewhere in their local neighbourhood, like a bench or a sheltered area. And I quite like the entrances to churches because they're very picturesque. A lot of people walk past. And then you just leave it there. You can take a picture and you can post it on your social media if you like. Again, that is completely optional. And then people can see that you've left it there. But more often than not, it's just someone walking past who spots it. And the finder will discover it. The sticker says, take this book, read it, and leave it for the next person to enjoy. And the idea is that they do just that. But again, they can keep it for 3 years if they want. It's still another life to that book. And then when they get round to it, they'll remember that it's a book fairy book, and they can put it back out there in the world. And it doesn't even have to be local to them. You know, people take them traveling, obviously not at the moment, but when they're traveling, they'll often take 10 books with them to hide in that country or in that town. So it just spreads and spreads and spreads.
And that's it for the speed round. I did promise you a favorite idiot of the day to end things off. This one goes back to show number 0548. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
Or should I say the year? A man entered a Lafayette, Indiana convenience store, pulled a knife, and demanded money from the two clerks. The clerk simply closed the security enclosure they were in, and the man left without any money. Police were able to quickly identify 42-year-old Sean Yoakum and arrested him on charges of attempted robbery and resisting law enforcement. The reason for the quick capture? Yoakum was readily identified by one of the clerks, his brother. Now, why, oh why, would you try to pull an armed robbery at the very convenience store that your brother works at? And if you were so determined to go down that road, why wouldn't you at least check first on when your brother was working so that you might be able to avoid when he's on shift for your crime? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0593. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0593. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, Verdant Square Radio, KDXRadio.com, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, CKUW-FM in Winnipeg, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Before we go, we'd like to leave you with a helpful instructional message from the National Association of People Who Have Trouble Walking and Chewing Gum at the Same Time. Step, chew, step, chew, step, chew, step, step. Oh, God. I always screw it up.